Would anybody like to lead us in a prayer?
Thank you for the opportunity to be here with these gentlemen and grow along spiritual lines. We appreciate all of it, and we ask you to be with all of us as we go about the rest of the day. In your name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Am I going?
Okay. So, having made a personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We've been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. We have admitted certain defects, ascertained in a rough way what our trouble is. We put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which, when completed, mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. Okay? On page 73 it says, more than most people, the alcoholic or addict leads the double life. My experience is that that is an incorrect statement. When I look at my experience, I probably... there were probably 13, 14, 15 different lives I was trying to live. And it depended on who I thought you thought I was supposed to be as to how I showed up. I created a separation between me and everybody around me because whenever I would approach anybody in the relationship, I would hold back and wait for you to give me a clue as to who I was supposed to be before I was the person that I was going to be, because I didn't know. And God forbid you guys ever get together and talk about me and figure out that I'm a different person to each one of you. So I was not a double life kind of guy. I was a multiple life kind of person. Top of page 74, starts on the bottom of 73. We must be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live long or happily in this world. No big deal, right? Just if you want to live long or happily in this world, right? Rightly and naturally, we think well before we choose the person or persons with whom to take this infinite and confidential step. There's my instruction that I use to read inventory to multiple people. I find that much like how my fancied thoughts are in my head and the way that I tell a story, is that the first person I read inventory to, Tarek or somebody like that, I am as honest and transparent as I possibly can be while I'm reading my inventory. I really am. I'm doing the best I can. He gives me some considerations. For some reason, when I read the inventory to the second person, I'm thinking about Tarek's considerations as I read that inventory to the next person, and I'm positioning the presentation of my inventory. By the time I get to the third person, I can't remember what the position was that I was trying to do. So the third person that I read to probably gets the most revealing piece of inventory. And then everybody that I read to after that, I don't care, because the more people I read this inventory to, the more I just don't care about the resentment. The more I get free of what it is that I, the perceived harm. So to me, there's lots of value in it. Plus, different people know me in different ways and they may see different things. There was one time I was reading inventory to it was the fourth guy, and he says to me after I finished my inventory, "Wow, you are one entitled motherfucker." When he said that, that was not what person one, two, or three had identified. And when he suggested it to me, it was legitimately like, it confused me, because I had never considered myself somebody entitled. But it took the fourth person on this particular inventory to identify that element of me. To the point where now, when I start to see that person show up, when I'm talking to people, when I'm trying to get more out of a situation, which is kind of being entitled, I hear his voice. It was Drew. I hear his voice in my head, and it's just like, so there's freedom in that, right? There's freedom in sharing this inventory with multiple people, getting multiple perspectives, looking at it in different ways. There's a lot of instructions in here for who is supposed to receive or how a person's supposed to receive our inventory. Down at the bottom of page 74, there's instructions. Notwithstanding the great necessity for discussing ourselves with someone, it may be one is so situated that they're on a deserted island and there's no suitable person available. That may have been the case when the book was written, but today, if you can't find somebody to read inventory to, you're just not looking hard enough. If and only if, then, that is so, this step may be postponed only, however, if we hold ourselves in complete readiness to go through with it at the first opportunity. We say this because we are very anxious to talk to the right person. If I'm getting ready to listen to your inventory, I get to right here, and this is where I go, "Do you believe that I'm able to keep your confidence?" I wait for the person to say yes. Do you believe that I fully understand and approve what you're driving at? I wait for them to say yes. Do you believe I will not try to change your mind? Well, we must not use this as a mere excuse to postpone. Then I read this, and I say, when you decide who's to read your inventory, you waste no time. You have written an inventory of your and are prepared for a long talk. You explain to your partner what you were about to do and why you have to do it. And then I stop and sit back. And I want them to explain to me why they think they're reading the inventory. There's not a necessarily right answer, but I want them to understand the magnitude of what we're getting ready to impart on. Usually somewhere in there I explain to them that a fifth step to me is sacred. Absolutely sacred. There is nothing that a person shares with me in a fifth step that they should ever hear me ever talking about or hear some sideways thing that came out. It is so important to me that my reputation, at least around the fifth step, is one of, you tell it to Brandon, he will never share it with anybody else. I believe so strongly about this that if you implicate, if you tell me something that's around a crime, I'll perjure myself by not sharing that if I ever get put on the stand. Because my God, I believe, is big enough that it's going to give me a judge that's in the program that will protect me from sharing your inventory. That's how big my God is. So you tell it to me in a fifth step, it's sacred. The reality is that as I've listened to enough of these fifth steps, there's really not anything new. There's not anything new. I'm looking for patterns. That's all I'm listening for. When you're reading it, it's just like, okay, well, there's a defect. That's a defect. Okay. Wow. Okay. So read that. Read your pride again here. Okay. Now go back like 3 pieces of inventory to your aunt and tell me what your resentment. Oh, okay. So you're pissed off at your aunt over here for doing what you think that you need to do here. And I'm connecting the dots for them. I'm getting them to see how the way that they are irritated with one person, they're showing up as that person in another relationship. And I believe part of what leads to our failure is the fact that we've got this vacillation between I should be this way, 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 that it starts to create confusion in our mind, which leads me to have to get rid of the confusion by just numbing it out. And if I don't see both sides of the way that I show up in relationships, I'm never going to realize that this ping pong match is going on in my head. And the ping pong match is what causes me discomfort. Confusion. Back and forth, back and forth. Should I, should I not? Should I, should I not? Right? And then we've got these incredibly wonderful fifth step promises that come after we've read this inventory. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken the step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. If any of you ever go see a counselor, ask him how many sessions it's going to take for you to be alone at perfect peace and ease. That's pretty big deal, isn't it? Who in here saw me during the break today? What was I doing? Nothing. I was alone. Perfect peace and ease. I walked around. I walked through, saw you guys working out. Walked through the garden. Walked through the greenhouse. I spend the better part of 4 days from sunup to sundown in the car by myself. I would say 75 to 80% of the time, complete silence. No radio, no book, no conversation with somebody else, complete silence. Alone at perfect peace and ease. You know why I think I can do that? Because I've read enough inventory, I've written enough inventory, I've read it to enough people, I've learned how to meditate, and I've cleaned up enough of the damage of my past that my mind's not cluttered up with all that stuff that most people's minds are cluttered up with. It allows me to be free and float through life. If I see something interesting in the garden, I stop and look at it. And I'm present with whatever that is. Inventory is the beginning of the coolest experience that you'll ever have if you actually do the rest of the stuff. Our fears fall from us. Man, that's pretty cool. We begin to feel a nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink or drug problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. Sign me up.
Thanks, Brandon. So the name of this workshop that we are doing with you guys this weekend is the What Any Length Looks Like Big Book Experience. We call it the Wall. We're giving you our version of what any length looks like for the two of us. I, like Brandon, have read Inventory probably in the ballpark of 40 to 45 times in almost 11 years. I just read to two guys that I went through the steps with a month ago. The year before, I read to Brandon and another guy around a fire. The year before that, I read to five different people. Why do I do that? I believe that the more people that truly know me, the more open I am, the more whatever God is tends to disclose to me what the universe is in terms of how I relate to it and how I exist in it. So I have found that practice very beneficial, and it creates a high degree of accountability in your life, and also creates a degree of bonding and guidance in your life, because you can't help but bond with someone to some degree when you do a fist up. And the more people we're bonded to in this fellowship, the less likely we're going to be taken out of the fellowship in the program. The more people that we defer to in form of guidance, there are several men that I will go to for guidance, the more likely it is I'm going to stay here. The more self-examination that I'm involved in and self-reckoning, the fifth step is almost like a self-reckoning. You know, it's like a confessional, and then you're usually given some ideas about what you possibly may want to do next. So not only have you become accountable, you've recognized something, you have verbalized that you might be willing to do something different, and you get the guidance to do it. These are all important aspects of the spiritual path, and you're forced to contemplate. You always come out of a fifth step contemplating something. And these, you know, contemplation, self-examination, self-recognition, bonding, guidance, these are all very, very basic in the spiritual way of life. And they're available to you through these steps, specifically this fifth step. And now, it's interesting, the first step was nothing but self-examination, if you really look at it. You turned inside. Second step, you had to turn to God. And the third step, you turned to other people because you are compelled to bear witness. That's what the third step is really about. It has nothing to do with turning it over and taking it back. It has everything to do with coming back here and testifying about the power of God in your life, bearing witness to what happens when God removes those difficulties. And we help show people His power, her power, His love, His immense capacity in this world. And then it's our responsibility to share that with people. Now in the fourth and fifth step, we're back into self-examination. In six and seven, we're going to turn to God. And then in eight and nine, we're going to turn back to others. And the fifth step has been instrumental, I think, in grounding me in this way of life. Back in 2014, I went through the steps. I fist-stepped with a guy. And instead of, you know, we Brandon didn't touch on it, but there's this part of the fist-step called the hour returning home. And it's just where you look at your first five proposals, the first five steps, and you ask yourself if I left anything out. And he didn't have me do that. He said, all I want you to do for 1 hour, no meditation, no prayer, no books, no music. I just want you to sit alone in perfect peace and ease. And it was one of the more impactful hours returning home that I've done over these, you know, 11 times through the steps. I, like myself, during the break, I know several, a handful of you saw me in here. I was content just sitting here. It's Brandon and I both live very full lives, and so we greatly value the retreat that we, when we get the retreat and do, and have our form of self-reflection and our own practice of what it is each of us does to be conscious of the presence of God in our lives. The fifth step being an instrumental piece of that. I have to share an experience about my first fifth step because it really, it was a game changer for me. I don't know about you guys, but the first time I did a fifth step was the first time I was ever honest with another human being about every part of my life. Up to that point, there wasn't a human being on this planet that knew everything about me. And there were all those things that I swore I'd take to my grave, and they were in my inventory, most of them, if not all of them, in my sex conduct. And I remember going over to Randy's house, and we would go on Sunday, and he would listen to my fifth step for 3 hours. And I also had a 1-inch binder of my first one. And the stuff that I swore I'd take to my grave was about 2/3 of the way through the binder. And so the first like 3 or 4 Sundays, and it took like, I don't know, I can't remember, but 6 or 7, maybe even 8 Sundays. I mean, it was a long fifth step. And am I going to share this with him this Sunday? Am I going to share this with him this Sunday? And I remember getting to it, and the needed power to share it with him was there. And this was probably one of the most beautiful experiences. I was expecting something, but I was not expecting what I got was him laughing. He's like, man, I've done that. And he started sharing his stories, and that was probably one of the most healing experiences of my life. Because I've always thought if anyone ever found this out about me, it'd be over. It's like one of those things I might put a gun to my head over. And this man did none of that. And I will always remember the walk from his house to my car, and the sense of freedom that I experienced from that first vista. And I've had degrees of that same effect produced, not every year, but that has happened again. And those fifth step promises are so amazing, probably some of the best in the book. Who wouldn't want to experience those to some degree more than one time? So again, we're just giving you our version of what anything looks like. But it's important that we practice this step, but that we always, that you trust who you do the step with. A closed mouth friend. This is serious stuff here. This is one of the traditions within our steps that cannot be violated. We can't share this step. It's confidential. So I've had the honor and privilege of listening to a lot of fifth steps. I've watched a lot of really cool experiences happen in fifth steps. I've seen a lot of emotion. But it's not the last step. More work has to be done. More action has to take place. And that's how we roll into steps 6 and 7. Want to add anything?
Yeah, I wanted to add a couple things. I've listened to enough addicts and alcoholics fifth steps. I'm not going to say every one of them, but there are two things that show up. Well, there's one thing that shows up in alcoholics inventory almost always is there's a lot of dishonesty around their relationship and intimacy and cheating and things like that in just about every alcoholic's fifth step I've ever listened to. Just about every addict's inventory I've listened to has had some sort of homosexual experience with a man that is not a homosexual. Okay? So I'm telling you that in this room right now, because there's somebody in this room that has that one of those experiences that they don't want to share. Guess what? You're not that different. There's really not that much strange stuff. It's packaged differently, but there's not that much strange stuff that comes up in a fifth step that I haven't heard. And the reality is that if the person that you're reading your inventory to has listened to enough of it, pretty much the minute we walk out of wherever we are, where I've listened to it, I've already forgotten it because it's flown into the rest of everybody else's. Okay? But I'll tell you another thing that's fascinating to me about me listening to Fifth Steps. Is I'll listen to a guy's fifth step. I'll give him some considerations. He walks away from the fifth step feeling some relief. And I walk away from the fifth step as the receiver, realizing I've got some work to do myself. Because some of the considerations that I'm giving him, the voice in the back of my head's going, that sounds great. Why don't you consider that? Okay. So just me being there for the other person helps me grow too. And I don't... It's an honor and a privilege to listen to somebody's fifth step. I don't particularly enjoy it. But it's something that I do to help them, and it's something that I get a benefit out of. Okay? If you go to somebody that's... I mean, it happens in early sobriety. People get real excited that you want to share inventory with them because it allows them to create that intimacy. But if you go to somebody that's been around for a real long time and they seem like they're really excited to listen to your inventory, it might be a little strange, okay? Yeah. Might want to consider who you're talking to because they may not keep your confidence, right? So make sure you know the person you're entering into that engagement with. And don't leave your inventory sitting around to where your significant other can find it.
Yeah, we've watched some not so nice things.
I say that to everybody that I talk to, and there's a guy that he kept it in a drawer and his wife found it 3 years later, and she went apeshit over some stuff that really didn't even have to do with her. It had to do with when they were dating, the way that he presented the relationship to her, and there was some stuff in his sex inventory that, like, he wasn't honest to her, like, 25 years ago, and she read it in the inventory, and she's just like, well, that's not what you said to me. And it caused, like, a rift for a while. Just don't. The rest of the world doesn't understand what we do, and... If they see, if you write inventory the way that Tarek and I do, with the third column being the way that it is, somebody that picks that up might want to put you away for a little while because it sounds a little kooky. But that's how it shows up. Tarek talked about the returning home. This is kind of the beginning of the six. Kind of the beginning of the sixth step, right? Is that returning home? Bottom page 75. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our hearts that we know Him better. Taking this book down from the shelf, I tend to be a literalist, so I put it on a shelf so I can pull it down. We turn to the page which contains the first, or contains the 12 steps. Carefully reviewing the first 5 proposals, or steps, asking if we have omitted anything, for we are building the arch to which we shall walk a free man at last. Okay? And then there's some questions here. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put in the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? Now, returning home is almost as important as the actual reading of the fifth step, I have come to discover. There are guys that will have an incredible transformative experience in reading the fifth step. They don't do returning home for a couple weeks, and then they get crazy as hell, and they don't understand why, because it's something like it just kind of seals it in place. You go back, you review what the if I'm listening to your inventory, I've got a list of your amends that I believe that you owe, and some of your grosser handicaps, I give it to you, and I want you to go back and sit and review that when you get home. And then call me the next morning with the next instruction. It seems like when a guy doesn't do that, it's like he thinks he's done. He thinks the fifth step's over, good, now I get to relax. No, it's not what it says. So this is an important part. About 25 to 50% of the time, I get a call the next morning that says, hey, I left this out. The guy's incredibly apologetic. I didn't mean to leave it out, but hey, I just didn't think about it. And it's usually something minor, and I'm like, cool, all right, great, you told me. Now we're ready for six. It's that reflective time period that if you have left something out intentionally, it will sit with you and it will make you really uncomfortable to the point where the next morning you actually come. Or it'll just kind of seal it all up for you. Is that kind of your experience too? And then we turn to page 76. And we have these two paragraphs that wrap up two steps that are, to me, two of the most magical spiritual steps and experiences that you could possibly ever have. And people just kind of rush right over them because they're just two paragraphs. Okay? So if we can answer the questions to our satisfaction on the prior page, we look at step six. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all these things we have admitted are objectionable? Okay? There's a question there with one question mark and two questions. If I've actually done this process properly to this point, the second part is, have I admitted the way that I am is objectionable? The way that I've been living my life, is it no longer acceptable to me? If I look at the list that Tarek or somebody else has given me, and I sit with it, is it a list of qualities that I want to continue to show up with in my own life? The need to dominate, the need to be right, the need for you to submit to my way, the need for me to constantly be controlling. Does that sound appealing? There's a ton more in my book. I always keep them when people give them to me. Like these things that like I see when I look at this list, I see that this is me separating myself from everybody else. And if I've done a thorough first step, I see my powerlessness. My first step, we go back to the first step when we redo the steps. I want to see the areas of my life today where I'm powerless. It's no longer about alcohol for me. It's about money. It's about sex. It's about control. It's about different things, right? So when I see my failure and I submit to it in the first step, I see the need to seek help from God in the second step. I ask for the help in the third step. It shows up to me in black and white in the fourth step. I read it to somebody else. They point out some other areas where I didn't see it. When I get to six, I don't want to be that way anymore. I'm tired of that guy. So have I admitted that it's objectionable? Because only then am I going to be willing to ask God to remove these things from me. Only then.
In the big book, step six is one small paragraph between our completion of the fifth step and when we return home and our readiness to approach God in step seven and humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. First time I went through the steps, step six came and went rather quickly and abruptly. It was difficult for me to differentiate step six from step seven. Looking back, it seems as if I took both steps at the same time. My sponsor asked me if I was willing. I answered yes. Then he gave me the directions to review my list of broad and general defects, which became apparent during the fifth step. The list included things like selfishness, dishonesty, jealousy, and envy and inconsideration. Since I was willing, I asked God to remove them in step seven, and we moved on to step eight. So don't confuse what I'm saying. It was exactly how I was supposed to work the step. But since that, I've come to realize that step six is much deeper than that initial experience. For the next 18 months, I heard other people, I used to go to meetings. I remember this guy doing, he was leading discussion, and he was talking about 6 and 7. He made a comment, these are the steps which separate the men from the boys. And I discounted that statement because I rarely ever looked about my character. And I directed the people sitting up front chairing that meeting to get off their asses and go help someone work the steps. Why did I exhibit so much hostility? I believe it was due to my lack of experience with step 6. About a year and a half in, I was introduced to the concept of revisiting the first 9 steps. And I was open to the idea at that time because I found myself suffering a great deal. I thought I'd missed something. There was just something didn't feel right. I was easily annoyed by a lot of people and situations in my life. I was often uneasy and dissatisfied with what my life looked like at the time. So I knew internally there was more. So as I reflect back, it's evident to me that in the beginning, the only thing which truly changed about me was my willingness to do whatever I had to do to recover from my addiction to crack cocaine. At the outset, little else about my character had changed because I was not entirely ready. The surrender to self that happens in the third step truly had not been addressed. So if I wasn't entirely ready, there's got to be a significant, there's the difference. So there's 3 concepts that we talk about in this in the 6 and 7. Am I willing? Is it objectionable? Am I entirely ready? Over the last several years, I've discovered the necessity for myself in reworking these first 9 steps every year. In that work, I've uncovered the difference between those concepts that I just mentioned, the willingness and the readiness. I've been willing to have many defects and shortcomings and the grosser handicaps removed, but my entire readiness only emerges when they become objectionable. The defect's last flicker of value has got to be snuffed out before it becomes objectionable. Otherwise, it's going to remain. I've also discovered a defect is usually removed while it's causing a great deal of pain and suffering on its way out. So usually when it gets, and I don't want to, let's go back, scratch out that word removed. I don't think defects get removed. I'm sort of paraphrasing an article I wrote a few years ago for this newsletter. Someone asked me to write an article on step 6, so I wrote this. And I think it's a good progression of what happens to a lot of people. But I don't think, think about it. Addiction or alcoholism is a defect of character. It's our grossest handicap for those of us in this room. And it only goes into remission. It doesn't get removed. If I don't take the steps necessary to stay conscious of the presence of God in my life, it's coming back for me. I'm 100% convinced of that. So therefore, it's not just removed. Because when you remove something, it means it's gone. It just goes into remission. If I'm getting something of value from something that we're going to refer to as a defect or a shortcoming, that I will, it's going to continue to show up, and I will not be entirely ready or unable to ask God with humility, sincerity, and authenticity to remove them in the 7th step. I'll continue to believe I can do something to change myself, and I'll become ready when my experience with utter powerlessness to remedy the situation is clear to me. I cannot change myself. You know, let me end with this. My attitude has changed regarding defects and shortcomings. The personal struggles are now blessings, because my personal struggles are usually conjoined with my shortcomings and my grosser handicaps. And I thank God for them, because it is He who is refining my character by blessing me with the pain and the struggle caused by my defects and my shortcomings. In short, it is these very things, these defects or grosser handicaps, that generate the struggle, and it is the struggle that will typically send me back into my relationship with God if I'm conscious of His presence in all things. So, without the darkness of struggle, I don't think I personally ever would know the light of victory. That's my own personal realization for me. And when I first got clean and sober, it was the defects and the handicaps were, oh, you're slothful, and you procrastinate, you're lazy, you're selfish, you're a liar, you're controlling. Very, very broad. So so why is it I become judgmental? Why is it I become controlling? Why do I procrastinate? Why do I attempt to, you know, put everyone into submission? Why is it? Because of the grosser handicaps I mentioned earlier. I live by this code that I need to be validated for others, so you must submit to me. I have to be respected to live. You know, I want all of the success, but I don't only want to do half the work. I need to be important. I think dishonesty is better than honesty on some level inside. This is like, these are old. These are from past inventories. I've just kept a list over the years. The belief that God will fail me. So what happens? I exert more. I exert control more. I'm the producer of confusion rather than harmony. I'm a self-seeker even though I'm trying to be kind. I'm living in constant collision with people and situations. I live by self-propulsion. All these things start to happen as a result of these grosser handicaps, and then we describe them using words like selfish and inconsiderate and self-seeking, which is fine. But we need to go to, you know, it's like those are almost like the branch, and to me, the self-defeating principles are the root. Okay? But there's an immense amount of mercy and grace in the struggle for me. The anguish and despair are necessary for this whole deal for me. They're part of the flips back and forth, so I truly know what happy, joyous, and free is through my knowing of what the anguish and despair can cause. And truly, the moments in my sobriety and in this path that have led to the most significant amount of growth have been the areas that I have struggled in the most. As a result, typically, of a grosser handicap. Because you'll experience what we call a dark night of the soul, and it's usually going to involve shortcomings and handicaps. The dark night descends on a soul only when all other things have failed. When you're no longer the best meditator in the class because your meditation produces absolutely nothing. When your prayer evaporates and your tongue, and you have nothing left to say to God. When you're not even tempted to return to a life of worldly pleasure because the world has proven empty. And yet taking another step through the void of the spiritual life feels futile because you are no good at it. And it seems as if God has given up on you. You can scarcely conjure up your old passion for Him. It has become clear that you're unable to do anything on your own to remedy your spiritual brokenness. And I experienced this to a degree as my marriage ended last year and my father passed away in the same month. And I was taking care of my dad, and I was putting my dad in diapers, administering his Dilaudid and his morphine and his Ativan and his Valium and his Oxycontin. He was passing from liver cancer. Getting to sit by his bed and meditate and pray and read scriptures to him, play music for him, rub him, rub his head, whisper in his ear, all these things. And at the same time, my marriage is falling apart. I'm homeless at the time. I don't have a place I call home. I'm living with a friend of mine in her extra bedroom. And I went to this really dark place, although I was showing up. I was there to witness. I had a teacher that guided me through that whole process, and he said, your job is to do nothing but witness. Witness your dad's transition. That's your only job. You don't have to comfort anyone outside of this. Just witness, be respectful. And then I witnessed the effect that death has on people that see it a totally different way. I saw it as a beautiful process because my dad and I were complete. My dad and I didn't even know my dad until after I got clean, guys. My dad was an alcoholic, a violent drunk that beat me and my brother, that beat my mom, that was emotionally, verbally abusive. But what happened in my first fifth step, I found out I turned into my father. Every single thing, all 16 or 17 resentments I had towards my dad, I had done to someone. And so Randy, in my first fifth step, continually started to ask me, have you done that? Have you done that? Have you done that? And at some point when he was asking me, my head dropped and I said, I'm just like my dad. And he's like, yeah. And in that moment, what was born was compassion for my father. So when I went to my father to make the amends, I was real clear. And I began to build a relationship with him because I had not had a relationship with him up to that point. And my dad and I became closer to my dad than any other member in the family. And so I guided my dad. I sat beside him and I sat there for him. But I went to this dark place because I'm a man of my word. I'm a man of integrity. And I just failed as being a husband and a father. And my marriage is falling apart. And I had succeeded in attaining all these wonderful things that society and culture says you're supposed to have. And the house was gone. And the wife was gone. And the daughter was gone. And I'm sitting without a home on my knees in my friend Lindsay's bedroom begging with the most sincere prayers for God to keep me safe and protected because I was losing my mind. You know, I was having to deal, like, just because I said it was a beautiful experience being there for my father, it was a very exhausting and stressful experience because I'm having to stay up and do overnight shifts, and my aunt, his sisters are there, and his cousins are there, and my mom is there, and my brother is there. And it's not really good between my brother and I, and I'm going back to Lindsay's at night, and you would say that I was exhibiting a lot of the bedevilments. You know, I was full of fear at times. I was unhappy. I couldn't control my emotional natures at times, but I was still going to God. I was still acknowledging God in all of it. And I remember one of my spiritual mentors, he asked me, I was telling him about the begging that occurred in prayer. And he said, it's not really begging. He goes, how sincere are these prayers? Is your heart present in your prayer? And I said, my heart is more present than any time I've ever experienced in my prayer life. And he goes, how beautiful is that? And that's when it hit me. You know, a lot of my defects of character, quote unquote, had led to the breakup of my marriage. You know, and I could see that. I could see the role that I, you know, where I had made mistakes and where I was at fault. But that drove me into a place, because most of the darkness that I was experiencing was not around losing my father, because, you know, he was 80 years old. It was more something that you have to expect when your parents are at that age. But what was not expected is the loss of my marriage at the exact same time. And that made me reflect on how I had shown up, which pushed me into feeling like I had failed, which led me into the prayer life as a result of these defects, to the most sincere prayer life I've ever known. And to me, it's taken a kid, like, you know, it's a version of what Brandon was describing yesterday with his defects of being important, wanting to be the center of attention. It serves a purpose this weekend. It's a blameworthy trait that now becomes a praiseworthy trait because it does make him effective with all of you. And those blameworthy traits that perhaps played a role in my marriage ending had put me down on my knees with God in a way that I'd never been on my knees with God before. And how can I not be grateful for that? We all have to be taken to these places where we're honed and we're polished by our struggles. And I'm a, you know, there are people who believe the path to God's all full of love and light, and I think it's a combination of light and dark. That's just my personal experience. I sent something to a sponsee the other day that I want to read to you guys. And then I'm going to...
want to read one thing and do the prayer.
You guys give me 1 second.
So, while he's looking that up, I love to talk to people about their defects and get them to see them with different light. I'm a guy that when I actually start hitting the gym, I will gain mass incredibly quick. It's my makeup. It's how I am. When I don't go to the gym, I gain weight incredibly quick. There was a guy I used to work out with that he looks a hell of a lot more fit than me. He could throw up just as much, if not more, weight than I can. But he was a rail. He was just an absolute rail, and he got pissed off as he watched me get bigger, and he stayed the same size. He was going up in weight just like I was, but he wouldn't grow. If you look at the defects in your life, they have the light and the dark attached to the same thing. It's just, how are you using it? How are people receiving it? There's so many other examples I can come up with.
One of the main concerns of many spiritual paths is to observe the fluctuation of the heart, not the mind. From state to state, usually triggered in instances of extreme powerlessness, typically behind defects that have been around for a while, and ultimately a journey of never-ending variegation or change. Our journey is a bumpy terrain, as it should be if we are to move, evolve, and to grow. In my opinion, we're on an inner journey of the heart to go through extreme polar states. On one side, we experience states of elation and ecstasy, happy, joyous, free. And I've read that these are often referred to as states of expansion. On the other side, we experience states of anguish and despair, the spiritual malady and its manifestations, the bedevilments, anarchic defects of character. Your recent and perhaps current state can describe that for yourself. But both are necessary and cannot be avoided. They keep the heart in constant fluctuation. The tossing and turning of our heart is needed and required as an experiential tool that eventually leads to a liberation from the swing of the opposites, expansion and contraction, calamity caused by defects of character and unmanageability can sometimes be our providence. Look the definition of providence up. Matching calamity with serenity. Calamity can be our providence. The oscillation or the variation between the two states creates the necessary friction or burning to cause suffering, which will eventually defeat the human mind. Your current powerlessness, interaction with others, and inability to be proactive happened to be what was going on with this sponsee, and unmanageability are the suffering and contraction I've described in this writing. If intended, this struggle can free us from the world of polarity and duality to the world of oneness. And it really shows us who the hell is in control, which is not either of any of us, in my opinion, and I think pretty sure in Brandon's opinion. So, you know, a lot of this stuff that I put together in this paragraph that I wrote is stuff, you know, I read. My idea of an exciting Friday night is listening to records and meditating and reading books. This is what I do. This is what I enjoy to do. There's nothing that makes me happier than sitting at home on a Friday and Saturday night and doing what I just described. So I read a lot and I reflect a lot and I write a lot. And this is one of the things I came up with. Now, none of this is original. Some of it's my own take on something I've experienced based on something I read. A lot of what I read describes my experience. I've had the experience. I just needed the description to put on top of it. And so there's an immense grace and mercy and gratitude that I have for my shortcomings and my defects. Now, is my goal to live in my defects? No. But when they show up, I want to be mindful and I want to live my defects instead of my defects living me. Okay, there is a difference between the two. As a result of that, what I said to those guys about 8 years ago, I told them to get off their asses and go help somebody work the steps. I think this is what everything's about now is step 6 and 7. Once you've been around for a while, this is everything in a nutshell. It's 6 and 7. Character, refinement. That's what the spiritual life is about. The spiritual life is not otherworld. It's not ethereal. It's embedded right here in day-to-day life and how we show up in relationships with other people based on this stuff. That's the spiritual life. You know, you don't have to sit on top of some mountain humming for hours on end.
You can,
but you don't have to be spiritual. It's about the human connection. It's about bonding and felicity with all of God's creations. Because we need it, especially our group as addicts and alcoholics, because isolation will kill us.
All right, so I've got one thing to read. It's a little bit long. So, and then if anybody's willing to do the 7-step prayer with me, I would like to do that. And then we'll take a break for dinner. So, this reading came back into my life within the last year. Tarek, at his program, I showed up one day and we actually did a workshop. What would you call that? What are your groups? A group around this reading. And this reading was in my life earlier, 3, 4, 5 years ago, and I've pulled this reading out 4 or 5 times in the last 2 months and read it to somebody, and they had a transformative experience. I'm not really sure where it fits into the steps, but it kind of seems to fit in right here because there's this we're dealing with all these beliefs and concepts that we used to think we should live our life off of, that we're starting to question in step 6 and 7 as a result of steps 4 and 5. So I feel like it fits in right here, and so this is when I'm going to read it. Luke 14:26 says, "If any man comes to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sister, yeah, and even his own life also, he cannot be my disciple." Okay? Take a look around the world and see the unhappiness around you and in you. Do you know what causes this unhappiness? You will probably say loneliness or oppression or war or hatred or atheism. And you will be wrong. There is only one cause of unhappiness. The false beliefs you have in your head. Beliefs so widespread, so commonly held, that it never occurs to you to question them. Because of these false beliefs, you see the world and yourself in a distorted way. Your programming is so strong, and the pressure of society so intense, that you are literally trapped into perceiving the world in this distorted kind of way. There is no way out, because you do not even have a suspicion that your perception is distorted. Your thinking is wrong. Your beliefs are false. Look around and see if you can find a single, genuinely happy person. Fearless, free from insecurities, anxieties, tensions, worries. You would be lucky if you found one in 100,000. This should lead you to be suspicious of the programming and beliefs that you and they hold in common. But you have also been programmed not to suspect, not to doubt, just to trust the assumptions that have been put into your tradition, your culture, your society, your religion. And if you are not happy, you have been trained to blame yourself, not your programming, not your culture and inherent ideas and beliefs. What makes it even worse is the fact that most people are so brainwashed that they do not even realize how unhappy they are. Like a man in the dream who has no idea he's dreaming. What are these false beliefs that block you from happiness? Here are some examples. First, you cannot be happy without the things that you are attached to and that you consider so precious. False. There is not a single moment in your life when you do not have everything that you need to be happy. Think of that for a minute. The reason why you are unhappy is because you are focusing on what you do not have rather than what you have right now. Another belief, happiness is out in the future. Not true. Right here and now, you are happy and you don't even know it because of your false beliefs and distorted perceptions have got you caught up in fears, anxieties, attachments, conflicts, guilt, and a host of other games that you are programmed to play. If you would see through this, you would realize that you are happy and you do not even know it. Yet another belief. Happiness will come if you can manage to change the situation you are in and the people around you. Not true. You stupidly squander so much energy trying to rearrange the world. If changing the world is your vocation in life, go right ahead and change it. But do not harbor the illusion that it is going to make you happy. What makes you happy or unhappy is not the world and the people around you, but the thinking in your head. Might as well search for an eagle's nest at the bed of the ocean as search for happiness in the world outside you. So if it is happiness that you seek, you can stop wasting your time trying to cure your baldness or build up an attractive body or change your residence or job or community or lifestyle or even your personality. You realize that you could change every one of these things. You could have the finest looks, the most charming personality, the most pleasant surroundings, and still be unhappy. And deep down, you know this is true, but you still waste your effort and energy trying to get what you know cannot make you happy. Another false belief. If all your desires are fulfilled, you will be happy. Not true. In fact, it is these very desires and attachments that makes you tense, frustrated, nervous, insecure, and fearful. Make a list of all your attachments and desires And to each of them say these words, deep down in my heart, I know that even after I've got you, I will not get happiness. And ponder on the truth of those words. The fulfillment of desire can at most bring flashes of pleasure and excitement. Don't mistake that for happiness. What then is happiness? Very few people know, and no one can tell you, because happiness cannot be described. Can you describe light to people who have not been sitting, who have been sitting in the darkness all their lives? Can you describe reality to someone in a dream? Understand your darkness, and it will vanish. Then you will know what light is. Understand your nightmares for what it is, and it will stop. Then you will wake up to reality. Understand your false beliefs, and they will drop. Then you will know the taste of happiness. If people want happiness so badly, why don't they attempt to understand the false beliefs? First, because it never occurs to them that they are even false or even beliefs. They see them as facts and reality. So deeply have they been programmed. Second, because they are scared to lose the only world they know. The world of desires, attachments, fear, social pressures, tensions, ambitions, worries, guilt, with flashes of pleasure and relief and excitement which these things bring. Think of someone who is afraid to let go of the nightmare because, after all, that is all the world knows, of all he knows of the world. There you have a picture of yourself and of other people. If you wish to attain to lasting happiness, you must be ready to hate father, mother, and even your own life, and take leave of all your possessions. How? Not by renouncing them or giving them up, because what you give up violently, you are forever bound to. Rather, by seeing them for the nightmare that they are. And then whether you keep them or not, they will have lost their grip over you, their power to hurt you. And you will be taken out of the dream at last, out of your darkness, your fear, your unhappiness. So spend some time seeing each of the things that you cling to for what it really is, a nightmare that causes you excitement and pleasure on one hand, and worry and insecurity and tension and anxiety, fear, unhappiness on the other. Father and mother, nightmare. Wife and children, brothers and sisters, nightmare. All your possessions, nightmare. Your life as it is now, nightmare. Every single thing that you cling to and have convinced yourself you cannot be happy without, nightmare. Then you will hate father, mother, wife and children, brothers, sisters, and even your own life. And you will so easily take leave of all your possessions. That is, you will stop clinging to, thus have destroyed the capacity to hurt you. Then at last you will experience the mysterious state that cannot be described or uttered, the state of abiding happiness and peace. And you will understand how true it is that everyone who stops clinging to brothers and sisters, fathers, mother, children, land and houses, is repaid 100 times over and gains in eternal life. Eternal life is right now. And the more aware of the false beliefs that you have in your head, the more free you become to experience life without the filter of all the things that you think life really is. So, on page 76, there's a 7-step prayer. I didn't do the 3rd-step prayer because I think that if you do it, it sometimes opens up some bad juju into your life and shows you some things that you're unaware of. But the 7th-step prayer, it kind of closes everything out, and it kind of makes you really submit to the reality of your life. So I'm going to sit here quietly, and then I'm going to say prayer, and then I'm going to say the prayer. If you would like to join me, you can read along. If not, that's fine too. Completely up to you. Prayer. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect, character which stands in my way of my usefulness to you and my fellows.
Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen.
Dinner break.